Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's April 25th, 2021, and welcome to episode 233 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and all kinds of stuff, making games for old computers and the like. I'm Paul Hagstrom in Boston. I am joined by two retro computing enthusiasts today. The first on my screen is Carrington Vanston in Toronto. How are you?
I'm fantastic, both in Toronto and elsewhere.
Excellent, excellent.
I'm just generally maintaining a fantasticness in my mind.
Continuing around the small circle, we have Quinn Dunkey in Los Angeles. How are you?
I am also excellent in Toronto and occasionally Los Angeles. It's a great city. When I'm there, I'm
excellent. Makes people excellent. Yeah.
We are big in Japan.
And Canada, apparently.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. It's sort of a Canada-friendly podcast episode this time.
We're generally friendly.
Yeah, that's right.
Although Quinn and I might not be the best representations of friendly Canadian.
Yeah. I mean, Carrington's half American and I'm kind of a jerk that, you know, they kicked me out. So.
Yeah, I grew up sort of close to the border, perhaps honorary Canadian.
There you go.
Sure.
So the host's topic today is we decided making games for old computers and just sort of things related to that. I have a couple of ideas that have to do with sort of contemporary solutions. I think the idea was actually supposed to be sort of using modern solutions to create games on vintage platforms, but whatever. Packaging emulators in Steam, all kinds of things you can do. So, I don't know, what do you guys think about this? Anyone want to start opining?
I mean, as someone who's very enthusiastically doing some of this, I think it's fantastic. I think that it's kind of a golden age for retro game development just because of the amazing tools that we have. You know, we're at this point where modern computers are just ridiculously, stupidly, insanely powerful compared to the machines that you're developing for. And so you can do absolutely insanely, ridiculously stupid things. I mean, you can save 1 billion copies of the entire state of the machine, you know, and that's just nothing. So if you want to make an emulator that can go back in time one clock cycle at a time, like, that's just totally plausible. You know, that's that power differential between the development system and the development target is really fun and allows you to do some neat things, and it makes programming very pleasant. You know, it takes away all of the unpleasantness that we used to have to deal with. For example, every time you have a bug that takes the whole machine down, and so you reboot. You know, developing back in the day, you spent most of your day rebooting, right? And copying files from floppy disk to floppy disk because your project took three disks, and you know, you had to manipulate files just to compile or just to assemble. And you spent most of your time on housekeeping rather than actually writing code. And so today that is very much switched to where, you know, as we've talked about many times before, we have these build pipelines now where you can click one button and you've built a disk image and you're up and running in an emulator in a split second, which is pretty amazing. That iteration time is really it's really empowering.
Yeah, I can imagine going back. Like, it's bonkers. Yeah. I just wouldn't be interested in developing it at any other time. And it's funny because this kind of thing was somewhat done for the Apple II back in the day when you might develop on a Macintosh using MPW or whatever. But it's an order of magnitude difference. It's not really the same thing at all, because now it's all just on the one computer that says, yeah, I've got a couple hundred Apple IIs over there. What do you want me to do with them? And just like Clint says, you just hit one button or one menu choice or Command B or whatever, and boom, it's up and running in essentially no time. The workflows are incredible now. It's just seamless. It just becomes fun. It just becomes like doodling software. I love it.
Yeah, doodling software. I like that. Yeah, and it is a dirty little secret that a lot more cross development was done back in the day than people probably realize. A lot of Atari and Commodore software was written on Apple IIs as the host, just because Apple IIs had cheap 80 columns, you know, and that alone was enough reason to cross develop. And then there was always an advantage to having a separate machine to test your builds on, so that while it's rebooting because it crashed, you can keep looking at your code or whatever, and you can have maybe you have a hard drive or whatever on your development machine, or a 3.5-inch disk for more storage or whatever. So yeah, I think cross development has always happened, but now the power differential is really outstanding. I mean, so much so that at this year's Online KFest, we saw a demo of an entire development environment for multiple retro systems that existed entirely in a browser. Which is astonishing. Like, that's just easy to do now.
And it's actually pretty amazing to be able to just like look in from outside and see like what, you know, what is at this address in memory? What has caused this problem? What is it looking at that has led it to take this loop or this branch or whatever? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Even the simple tools like Virtual 2, you know, that where you can look at memory and step through, you know, and look at memory changing. I mean, that is just a simple thing, but it's so immensely powerful, and that kind of thing was almost impossible to do back in the day. I mean, we used to debug almost entirely through static analysis, you know, because it was pretty hard to get any kind of equivalent to a printf or a log or any kind of output from your program while it was running. You just didn't even have the spare power to do it.
Mm-hmm. What's also fun is a lot of the development environments, if you're going to do something for an old computer, it's the same thing. So if you, like I develop now and professionally, and if I want to make an Apple II thing, I'm in the same environment. Like, so it's very comfortable. I don't have to be doing something else. I have just a lot of muscle memory I'm bringing, and I can kind of like pause one thing and just say, well, why don't I go doodle on an Apple II thing or whatever for a while? And it's just like just switching over files. So that's really comfortable. And I think so many barriers to entry have been dropped now that if you are a developer and you want to get into doing something for a vintage computer, there's never been a better time. There's so many amazingly easy pipelines that just make it really fast and seamless to get your hello world out there or just start to, again, doodle some software for whatever your retro computing platform of choice is. It's really fun. It's removed just a lot of the headaches of development for old things, which is nice. I'm hoping that we see, like, we seem to see more and more, like, new games for old computers come out. And I'm hoping that's going to continue as a trend as more people get into it. I don't think it's going to be a money-making venture for almost anybody. You get Knox of Cash, you get the occasional, essentially, you know, AAA game for the Apple II, but that's not really going to be a thing. So it's going to remain hobbyists. And so because of that, I think there has to be a really easy way to get from idea to solution, because if you end up making it difficult and someone says, I got to plow through this for the 9 people that are going to play my game and give me no money, it's going to be really easy to make somebody give up. So it has to be as seamless and fun as possible. We're not going to get any end results.
Yeah, that's a really important point. And I think it's something that keeps a lot of people out of retro development. It keeps me from getting too serious about it, honestly, which is that, okay, I'm going to spend, you know, 5,000 hours developing a game. It's going to take me 5,000 hours, whether I target the Apple II or the Mac, a modern system. So do I want to spend those hours on something that millions of people can play or that 1,000 people might play? You know, it's kind of crappy math, unfortunately, that way. Mm-hmm. Which is why something like what Nux Archaeus did, I think, is really clever, where if you can package it into a double-click emulator that runs on modern systems, which, you know, that's a bit of a barrier on Apple II because of the, you know, the ROMs are still copyrighted, but there are some workarounds that people have for that. Does anybody remember the name of that ROM that someone did where it's like...
Just trying to think of that.
Yeah, it's not really compatible, but it has no Apple code in it. And so it's just enough if you want to package, you know, if you want to box up a game in an emulator, you can do it. That is certainly a barrier to entry for a lot of retro development.
Yeah, and it's funny that you mentioned that, like, you know, how working in this IDE or whatever that you use is you know, it's just like home. You're used to it. Because for me, I don't use Xcode for anything. So like I want to write a Apple II assembly program, I have to learn Xcode. and it's not easy. Like, what is a target? I don't understand. You know, like, what is a project? How are these libraries linked?
It definitely is easier if you spend a lot of time in Xcode already.
Yes. Yeah. Because that does lead me to say, all right, well, okay, here's Merlin. Let me run Merlin. I know how Merlin works, which is
it works on a tiny little window. So, I mean, what I couldn't do is go back. Quinn was saying how a big advantage in the Apple II back in the day was you got cheap 80 columns. The idea of programming with only 80 columns now, I'm like, not even interested. If I can have a giant window with multiple instances, don't even talk to me. Like, I'm too pampered. I could never go back to that.
It is funny when you look at like a source code, like the source code of an Apple II program, though, because it's like it all fits on your screen, you know, and you think that was long. I remember this being long.
Yeah, but it's like I want all the columns too, like because the source code's only that wide, right? Because it's like, you know, an opcode and a couple of mm-hmm. nibbles. So it's like when I'm retro programming, I have in Xcode, I have like 10 windows wide, and each window mm-hmm. is an inch wide, right? And so I can see lots of code at once, and I find that super helpful. But also just the ability to have long label names and not be constrained by, you know, what you can see on the screen or whatever, like 6 characters or whatever Merlin let you use for a label, you know, so you can have sensical method names and so on. It just makes the code so much easier to read. You don't have to worry about putting verbose comments in. Like I put huge data tables in my comments and stuff. I make everything documented right in the code because who cares? It doesn't matter if the source code fits on a floppy disk, you know, those little things. Real copy paste that isn't 68 keystrokes, you know, and if you do it wrong, you delete all your code or whatever. Like just mm-hmm. those little niceties. It's incredible what a difference they make.
Mm-hmm. When you, another thing too that fits into this, if you're developing like a modern game or something, or at least for people who live in 2021, you know, the appetites are different. You know, like people aren't necessarily going to want to play Aklabeth, you know, if you wrote it now.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
They've moved on in some way. So,
sort of related to that, I was going to talk about how, like, you know, we're all Apple people here, so we know about, you know, some of the sort of basic Apple cross-development options. But, I mean, we would weep at what the Commodore 64 people have, right? Like, they have entire IDEs custom-built specifically for cross-development of those games. And, you know, they have complete with integrated hyperlinked documentation and, you know, tutorials for common demo routines. And, you know, the development world over there is just enormous and extremely sophisticated. And I think, and part of the benefit of that is the access to information that we have now, right? Like all the documentation for everything that's ever been written is all online, and so you can find any obscure thing. You know, when I wanted to reverse engineer the 2C+ ROM, like the schematic was trivial to find. You know, that kind of thing, which would have been impossible back in the day. Mm-hmm. The flip side, though, of that is that the stakes, or rather the competition, is higher. So if you want to make a Commodore 64 game and hope to have 50% of the audience download it, it actually has to be very, very good, because the, you know, the people that are making the games in that space that get the headlines are incredibly talented. Like, they were people who were good back in the day, and they've only gotten better since, and now they have the benefit of all of the learnings from other people that are all on the internet now. And so you can't just go in and make, you know, my first Commodore 64 game and have anyone care about it, because they're porting Halo and doing crazy, crazy things on the Commodore 64 now. I don't know if you guys follow this Scald RPG that's being done on C64.
Mm-hmm. No.
6502 Workshop, Nox Archaeist, they've been retweeting a lot of the Scald tweets, which is the main reason I know about it. But it's a Nox Archaeist-style game, tile-based RPG for the Commodore 64, and it's incredible. I mean, the weather effects and the lighting and the, you know, the huge scale of sprites and some things that they're doing, and you look at that and you're like, okay, if that's the bar, then I'm not going to bother, because like, there's, you know, I'm not going to get anybody's attention with anything I could write, even with all these great tools.
Mm-hmm. So have either of you used 8-bit Unity?
No,
because I've used Unity in the real world, but I've not any experience at all with 8-bit Unity.
Well, and I think we've come across this before and decided that it actually is unrelated to the you know, Unity game engine that, I mean, maybe there's some, it feels like there it can't be a total coincidence, but I think it's a very light connection between those two conceptually.
But the idea is to use it to build, like, it's an SDK, right? I think for old computers, like in general, as a way to build old games. I just haven't used it.
Yeah, and I think Jack was going to do that, take a look at it, and then discovered that it was a Windows only development environment, and that was the end of Jack's interest. So I haven't actually taken much of a look at it, but I think you're right. It's you know, the idea is, you know, write once, target many places. So at least you get, you know, whatever it is, 50 instead of 8 people seeing it.
Most of my life, I have been against such things like Java and such, because it always seems to be a lowest common denominator thing where you write it once and you target everything. So if you like your operating system, you hate these results, because it just ends up looking like something not made for your operating system. And so just don't like it. But when you're dealing with older computers, I think there's less of a barrier to that. At least as a possibility that you could write something in one environment and then put out a proper native feeling thing in lots of different environments, just because of the power of what we have. I just don't know if 8-bit Unity is that thing or not. One development environment I have a little more in, well, it's not even a development environment, it's just a thing. Inform is a great way to make text adventures. Inform 7 is kind of the current version, and there was Inform 6 before that. There's also other ways to make text adventures for modern computers. And if you're interested in making a game for an 8-bit computer, one of the big barriers to entry can be like doing all the graphics. It's like, oh, not gonna do graphics, gotta do the sound. You gotta not just be a programmer and a writer, you've also gotta be an artist. And like, it's just, okay, yeah, programmers are artists, but whatever. So that can be a big barrier. And I happen to love text adventures. So if you are interested in making a text adventure for old computers, and making it on a new computer, there's a thing called Puny Inform that I've been enjoying very much lately. And it's essentially a fork of Inform 6 that's stripped down and specifically designed to target like Z3 and Z5 files, like to make a Infocom style game that will run on a Commodore 64 or an Apple II or something like that. So it targets that smaller memory platform. And it's super, super fun. I had really no experience with Inform 6 at all. But I was able to get up and running very fast. Documentation is a little sparse, but if you've done any kind of coding, it's not that difficult. And I've been really enjoying it. You butt up against limits, like limits all the time. It's like, nope, can't have another attribute. Too bad you use the 2 you're allowed. I'm like, come on. Whatever, it's like playing tennis. Who wants to play tennis with a net down? So it kind of makes it a little more fun. And I've been working on a game with basically a target of one. Pal and I are writing games for each other, so I'm not really concerned about it having a broad market. If other people play, great. I'm making it for one person. But it's got like 80 rooms or something right now, and I'm not even coming close to a memory limit. So you can make a very large, robust text adventure with a nice parser and all that, targeting, like in my case, an Apple II. And that's super fun. So people should look into that as well if you want to make a text adventure for old things. Puny Inform, highly recommended.
Cool.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned those limits. I don't, forgive me if you guys talked about that while I lost my Wi-Fi there, but in our notes, we have Arcade Machine as as an option or as an example of one of the tools from the period. And I think those could be really fun, but I think very quickly the limits would be frustrating, partly, as you said, like the number of variables, number of enemies you can have or whatever, but also just dealing with the disk space. Like if you use a retro tool now, you're going to have to, have this artificial limit of working from a floppy disk. And I think that is going to get old pretty fast.
Good point.
So
mm-hmm.
I suppose if you ran it from a disk image in an emulator, it'll be better, but you're still going to be limited to ridiculous, whatever, 10K or whatever, because that's what they had left on the disk, for the product or whatever. Those retro tools might be frustrating for the same reasons that they were at the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. A couple of the sort of contemporary things that I remember were then, I too am coming at this all from an Apple perspective, but at least all three of the ones that I am thinking of here are somewhat cross-platform. But Arcade Machine, I think that was I was going to say that's the least known of the three that I put down here, but it's basically just a Galaxian maker.
Exactly.
I forget who wrote it, but Doug, what's his name? Doesn't matter. I mean, it does matter. Let me look it up. Let me not
I thought
say it
was,
doesn't matter.
Wasn't it Gary Kitchen that did that? Maybe I'm wrong.
No, he did an Adventure Maker, I think.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, and Game Maker, Gary Kitchen Game Maker. Yeah, it'd be the guy from
Broderbund,
Doug Carlston, Broderbund guy, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's just I'm trying to get to the credits tab.
Oh.
Here we are. No, it doesn't.
Well, while you're Googling that, you mentioned earlier that Xcode was a barrier to entry for you, and I think one of the cool things about retro development is that the target is so far below the development platform that it's pretty IDE agnostic. You know, like we got Jeremy Rand in the comments there talking about how he's been looking at VS Code, which is something that I use a bit in my day job as well. And so if you want to use Emacs or whatever, because all you're doing is running, you know, CA65 or whatever, you know, basic command line stuff, and you're not trying to link 68, you know, modern libraries or there's no code signing or anything that would be that would tie you to a specific tool chain or anything like that. So it's pretty easy to build up a tool chain for whatever your preferred environment is, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just like a couple days ago installed VS Code, thinking that I would use it for LaTeX, you know, for just like text processing, because it has some stuff in that domain. But I mean, like, it seemed nice.
Yeah, it's a nice little environment.
So,
I use a little bit of it at work, but I mostly spend my time in Xcode still.
Yeah, we used it for a while because it used to be the only way to get source level debugging in C# on a Mac, and or any .NET stack. So now Rider has really replaced it as our daily driver. But Rider is another great IDE that's pretty target agnostic. If people are looking for an environment to use as a starting point for a new tool chain for retro development, I think Rider would be worth a look.
Yep. Plus, it's from what are they called? JetBrains.
JetBrains.
Come on, like for that name alone, from JetBrains.
Yeah.
Yeah. I actually use quite a few of theirs. Like I use RubyMine all the time, which is they basically have written the same program like 9 times with little tweaks for different languages, but it's all it's all basically the same environment.
Yeah, and I think you can kind of tell when a company cares about software and when it doesn't. And JetBrains, you can tell they care about Rider because it's getting updated very frequently. Bugs never stick around for longer than a couple of weeks. Like you load it up and, oh, it's been updated and now that thing that was annoying me is fixed. Like that happens constantly. Compared to like VS Code where it's like, yeah, it doesn't seem like anybody cares too much about this thing. Like it started as a reskin of a different tool, which the name of it escapes me now, but it didn't start out as, it's not a fork of Visual Studio, in other words, despite the name. It's actually a reskin of an older IDE, and it doesn't seem like anybody cares very much about it. It doesn't get updated much. It's got a lot of weird bugs. So, it's not an actively developed tool, I think, which does matter as well.
Mm-hmm. It is a little comical that the reason I installed it is because it, you know, I wanted a nice thing to process some text files. Given the scale of this thing I installed.
Yeah.
By the way, so the credits on the arcade machine are Doug Carlston and Chris Jochumson. So, they presumably wrote, they basically wrote this game for Broderbund and then said, well, you know, we might as well just take out our editors and put that on a disk too.
Yeah.
So this is one of the early things that I bought as a kid, and I used it a bit, and you know, I think it's probably sort of usable, but it was a way that you could make these things just on your own, I don't know, I think it had little sprite editors and things that I'm sure would be pretty painful after a while, like if your retro experience included development and what you wanted to do was get a nostalgic development experience, then maybe you would do this. But
yeah,
I wonder how many people do that though. How many people approach, like, they want to make an old game or old software, and the impetus isn't a nostalgia for the result, the game, it's a nostalgia for the development environment or development process.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sometimes I think about that. I'll think about developing on when I was on an old SE and stuff, and I don't know that that would live up to my memory.
No, 9 inches
very quickly. I'd be like,
very
nope.
Small screen.
Yeah.
Right.
There are definitely people that do have that interest, though. I can't think of a specific example, but I've seen people on the mailing list and stuff say, you know, oh, I'm developing this thing entirely, you know, in Merlin on real hardware because they do want that experience. So it does happen, I think. I don't know if anyone's ever finished a project of any size that way, because I think swapping floppy disks to run the linker and such gets old pretty fast. But
we're using old languages. I've got one of the show notes I'll be talking about is something in Fortran, which is still around, but this is old Fortran. And for text adventures, to circle back to that, the ZIL or ZIL language that Infocom used, people still want to develop in that, which is a weird sort of language. So you're targeting a kind of, in a sense, a more difficult, but maybe a more authentic experience for development. So everybody has their own thing. I'm just too much of a suck. I want everything easy.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think, I mean, like, I do sort of feel like we had more patience just both as game consumers and possible creators, you know, back at that time.
So much more time.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I think one thing that we haven't touched on yet that makes retro development really appealing is that by definition of being retro, the platform is frozen. It's static. And that's a huge, huge advantage. Like, any kind of modern development is such a moving target. Like, I've completely given up on developing iPhone apps, for example. I used to have a couple of apps in the store that I maintained. I gave up on all of them because every month, pretty much, Apple puts out some breaking change that I have to now go and update all of my apps for. Like, software is just continuous maintenance now. And every Mac OS 10 version that comes out breaks everything I've ever written. And even no matter how hard I try to do everything the way you're supposed to do it, you know, I wrote a game called Gate. It's on my mind because I just got another email about it this morning. And it was kind of an homage to Robot Odyssey 1, the Apple II game about, the successor to Rocky's Boots, where you wire up logic gates and use robots to solve problems. And I wrote a game like that, a puzzle game. This would have been 2005, something like that. And I targeted what at the time was a generic enough platform, SDL, and it ran on Windows, Linux, and Mac. But I didn't have the resources to maintain it. I mean, I put many thousands of hours into that game, finished it, and then there was about a year where people could download it and play it, and then it started breaking. And, you know, Windows could run it in some sort of emulation. Mac OS X wouldn't run it anymore unless you ran it from the command line to get around some package signing thing. And then it stopped working on Linux. And then I updated it once. And then I had to give up on it because it was free and it just wasn't worth my time to maintain it. So it's great that you write something on a Commodore 64 and it will always forever work on that, on all Commodore 64s because the platform is completely static. There's something very nice about that.
That's a really good point. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
Unless you write something for the VidHD or, you know, some sort of like streaming from a SD card or something.
Yeah.
In the comments going on, Curtis gave a couple of good comments about one of the advantages, like if you're used to that retro experience, you use old tools, but at least you can crank up the emulator speed. So you can use all that muscle memory, but still inherently make a faster process and get rid of a bunch of hurdles. So also a good point, Curtis.
Yeah. Yeah, and you can run off if the tools are compatible with ProDOS, you can run off a 32 megabyte disk image, which is effectively infinite storage for an Apple II. So that's, you know, you could do things like that as well, yeah.
That's the thing I'm surprised hasn't come out as much. If you're producing a game nowadays, I wonder what is the real reason to target a floppy disk size deployment versus saying, this comes on a 32 meg thing. I'm just loading stuff constantly. Why not? You're expected to run it on the emulator at 100 times speed. There you go. Just like, we all know you're running it that way. I don't care. And so you could target just do ridiculous things that you couldn't have done back in the day. I just haven't seen that yet so far.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So there is a little bit of that happening on Commodore 64. So there are some modern games that will only run on a quote-unquote cartridge. They'll only run on a virtual cartridge, and that's because they stream audio, for example, which the Commodore 64 floppy disk wasn't fast enough to do. So Rob O'Hara talked about this on a recent Sprite Castle episode where, there's a game that has a whole bunch of voice sound effects in it, but if you play the floppy version, you just don't get any of that because it can't do it quick enough. So the cartridge version does, but it's designed to be run on an emulator, basically as a virtual cartridge. But somewhere along the way, it starts to become a fantasy platform, right? Which is another area of retro development that's pretty big right now. There are a lot of these sort of fantasy retro platforms, things like the Pico and the Chip, mm-hmm. and these things that are like a retro platform. It has all the things we liked about them, you know, 16 colors and low res, but doesn't have all of the annoying limits like floppy disks and slow clock speeds. So you know, there are those options as well, which are pretty interesting. The problem there is there's too many of them. It's hard to pick one to target because there's 1,000 of them and each of them has 10 fans or whatever.
Right, exactly.
Right. Yeah.
I think that's all I got.
Yeah.
Go make games.
Yeah.
Or other things. There's other things people do, I guess. I just focus on the games, but I'm sure somebody out there is putting out the most amazing spreadsheet program ever or whatever. I'm out of that.
There's a fair amount of active BBSs. I don't know if anyone's developing new BBS software, though, or if people are just running the old stuff.
Mm-hmm. A lot of these things do have, this is probably just sort of like a life characteristic anyway, but there's a lot of opportunity for the excitement to begin a project, not to lead to the finishing of a project.
Yeah. So, that's every form of project, life anyway.
Yeah, every retro project I've done is like on a 10-year timeline. Like, I'm still working on that 2GS game about cats fighting, but it'll be done when it's done, and it's going to be years, and I'm okay with that. Like, every time I get on a plane, I work on it pretty much, and that's all the time I have for it.
And that's the thing, is because it's got to be a hobby, and because there's not somebody out there waiting, that's giving us an advance, waiting to publish his game or whatever, it's like, it's the thing that's always going to get delayed when other stuff comes up. So,
Yeah, I mean, look at Lawless Legends. I mean, that game is... There's been news about it lately. It's starting to surface again, but that game's been in development for many, many years. You know, but it's still going. It will be finished someday.
Yep, I heard about that long before I heard about Nox Archaeus, in fact.
Yeah.
It was like lapped by Nox Archaeus.
Exactly. Yeah, Nox Archaeus started and shipped during Lawless Legends.
Yeah, but it's not about getting it out first. I'm super looking forward to Lawless Legends. I'm still on board and looking forward to playing that.
So. Yeah, it's an amazing thing for sure. Yeah. Yeah, and they released a sub game during Lawless Legends development, right? They used their engine to make a mini game during the development of it. So.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Jeremy just had a good point in another Apple folks one, but in the chat about how he uses Kansas Fest as an artificial deadline, and that kind of thing can help impetus. I think Kansas Fest back when it was also a gathering, but now maybe to a slight lesser extent that it's virtual, but or other events like having that as I want to release at their target. Certainly, you want to put out your game at or before Kansas Fest, not 2 weeks after Kansas Fest. So otherwise, now you're delayed a year. So that could be a good way to keep yourself motivated.
It's true, yeah. Even if you just want to do a talk, like I did a talk a couple of years ago, I guess, about the terrain engine in my cats game, and it definitely, it wasn't ready when I signed up to give the talk. So it definitely motivated me to get it to a point where I could show it and demonstrate the technical stuff that I wanted to talk about. So, yeah, for sure.
So get out there and make games. Do it.
What is the thing that happens twice a year? The sort of everybody gets does a little retro project.
It's
Retro Challenge. That's what it is. Yeah, those even if they are artificial, it is, if you can convince yourself long enough to start the project.
That wouldn't motivate me, though. Like Kansas Fest, having to get up and give a talk and demonstrate something would motivate me to get it done. But the Retro Challenge is like, you kind of set your own goal. I've planned to do this and maybe finish a little bit and that counts and nobody really judged you. That's not enough to motivate me. I need shame to motivate me. I need to be able to stand in front of people, have them boo and throw things. That will motivate me. I need that. People throw things at me.
I think, in fact, relevant to like today's topic, a couple of these things were spawned that way for you, right? I mean, like you had an Apple II build pipeline that you did, and an Inform talk that you did, all like learning it on the way to Kansas Fest.
Right. Yes. Exactly. The Inform 7, and it was like, yeah. Because the point of the Inform 7 talk was, though, I heard it was so easy. I said I will learn Inform 7 during the person's talk before me, and then I will present on Inform 7, and it worked great. I was like, this language is so easy. In the last half an hour, I learned this, and now I can give a talk on it. But also, talk about lowering the bar for prep. I have to do. That's the other secret thing I do. And I was like, how can I make this so it's fun, but means I have to do the minimum preparation ahead of time. And then the Apple II build pipeline was, I noticed other people had created a bunch of things. I said, if you use these tools by other people, you have an Apple II build pipeline. Isn't that cool? I developed none of that. I was like, yeah. Use this thing from this person, tell this thing, and just use this one little script, ties them together, bingo, hit Command B, and you've got a game in an emulator, all of which were by other people. I just happened to notice other people mm-hmm. were doing amazing work. Again, I didn't have to do anything ahead of time. I noticed the thing, talked about it for half an hour. Perfect Carrington presentation. Love it.
And actually, there's a nice sort of like confluence of people involved in that project right here, right now, more or less, because Quinn took yours and...
Oh, that's right. Yes. Because next to that, I remember Jeremy then said, no, here's a proper pipeline. I was like, Jeremy, nice. It's like awesome. It's just fantastic. So... And then Jeremy's used that to put out 7,000 games every That's Kansas right. Fest and win all the awards. Stop it, Jeremy. You're shaming all of us.
That's right. Okay. Yeah, it's possible that we've made it far enough through that.
Yeah,
to
that's enough.
Move on
make some
to
games.
The next thing. Yes, go on. Go off. Make games. Let's see. Okay, so we got a little bit of feedback. Some of the feedback is... Well, okay, so first of all, I've lost track of what feedback we've talked about, but this is all sort of recent, which means that it largely has to do with episodes like three times ago. Although, actually, there was one Klaus from Sweden wrote to respond to episode 57. Some of you, that's a little
nice.
Ways back.
Retro computing rounds.
Yeah. Yes. Apparently, so
were we
going to
do that? Were we
going to
start
this?
Just talking about... Like our old shows, it's starting to make the research easier.
While, yeah.
I like it. Klaus, you're keeping us on. Nice.
But because apparently, I think Earl had said something along the lines of, you know, observing that Commodore 128s had the ability to run CPM kind of built into them. They were Commodore 64s and Commodore 128s and CPM machines. And I think he must have speculated in an offhand way that it maybe was the most common CPM computer. And Klaus came back to point out that MSX computers sold around like twice as many, and they could just run CPM on their own. And plus,
oh, okay.
Everybody pretty much ran Commodore 128s as 64s anyway. Mm-hmm. So from the retro corrections department is what I had called that. But another thing. So the this was actually just tweeted to us, I think, today. The Amiga Addict, maybe it wasn't today, doesn't matter, recently. Amiga Addict magazine was pleasantly surprised to hear so much Amiga talk. And so I wanted to sort of point out that there is a magazine. It's a sort of a, you know, currently produced magazine. They're just about to finish issue number 5.
Cool.
So if you are interested in this.
And what Quinn needs is a new Amiga user magazine.
Yeah, exactly. Well, since we're on that topic, I can close the loop because I think last time I was on the show, 7 mm-hmm. episodes ago or whatever, I was talking about how I was looking for Amiga introductory books for modern mm-hmm. retro users, and mm-hmm. I had actually found one. It was actually a programming guide that's a new book that was written recently on Amazon, and I said I would let you know how it was, and I have it now, and it's very good, actually. It's mm-hmm. more... It's more user-focused than I expected. It actually does have a decent introduction to using the machine. It's very thin, though, and most of it is just an SDK. It's documentation for the Amiga OS SDK. So, like, here's how you open a window, and here's how you, you know, create a file or whatever. So, and that's not super useful. But you know, it's nice that it exists, and I'm glad I bought it. So if you are interested in Amiga books, I think it is worth buying. I don't remember what it's called now. It's the name is forgettable. It's like Amiga Programming or something.
Mm. Cool. Yeah, actually also connected to that, feedback that I received an hour ago by phone.
As it turns what? Out. I'm sorry?
So you may know Alex J. Cox. He had just listened to these last couple of episodes, 228 and 229, and was kind of curious to know if there was interest enough for such a book to be written, because he feels like he has that information in his head and could produce such a book if it's likely that there would be people who would want such a book.
Well, ask Dr. Stephen Weirich, who wrote just such a book for the Apple II.
Yeah, mm-hmm. might be interested. Or David Finnegan also has the new Apple II user's guide too. That I think Stephen Weirich's is a little bit more history, and I think David Finnegan's is a little more usage. Yeah.
Sorry, I was confusing those two books. Yes, sorry. Yeah. Sorry to both of you. Yeah.
But
yeah, interestingly, no such book exists for the Commodore 64 that I could find. So. And that audience is 10 times the size of the Apple II audience. So it may just be the case that there aren't very many people going and thinking to write such books, I guess. They don't realize the market exists. I did find one book on retro game development, but not one on, like, here's how to become a Commodore 64 user in 2021.
Right. Yeah. And it's certainly not intuitive that you have to type :8, :1. What is that?
Yeah, exactly. And that's the kind of information that now is kind of hard to find. Like, either you were a user back in the day, and so you just remember that stuff, or you don't know. Like, same with the Apple II. Like, how do you move the cursor? How do you delete? Why doesn't delete on the Apple II work? Like, if you weren't a user from back then, that's going to be a giant mystery to you, and it's not going to make any sense.
Continuing on the non-intuitiveness of the Commodore, what is this load $ for getting a directory?
Yeah. It does make sense if you understand all the underlying mechanisms, but that information is, you got to read a lot of books to get that information now. Because I think $ is the name of the file where the directory lives or something like that. There's a reason for it that makes sense, but yeah.
So anyway, yeah, I guess those of you who are listening who are not Alex, we'd be interested to hear, or he would be interested to hear, I guess, if there is interest in this. I think, I would find it interesting. I have something, Amiga 500, something like that, I think, waiting to be used for something. I mean, I think I ran Pipe Dreams on it once and then turned it off again.
Good game.
Yeah. I do like that game quite a bit, but, and it was interesting to see it, you know, running on a different platform, but basically it's the same game. So, anyway, yeah. So the, what am I trying to say? Oh yeah, I guess maybe one other. Continuing with that feedback by phone, I got Alex also mentioned that just I think a day or two ago, maybe yesterday, I don't know, it doesn't matter. In the past, as you are listening to this on the feed, VCF East had a swap meet, like an actual in person swap meet where
eek in person.
Yeah,
I'm like triggered by that.
It went very well. So. Yeah, I mean, I guess it went well. I don't know. It does seem like it might be a little early, but they are looking to possibly do another such thing in the summer sometime because it went well enough. So
I will get my vaccine, my first shot on Tuesday. Can't wait.
Yeah,
been no in person for me in a long time. As an introvert, I don't 100% miss in person, to be honest. But
I think that is going to be interesting. You know what it's going to be like to go back to that, particularly for people who really were, you know, out in public a lot and then weren't. I mean,
I had a weird experience recently watching, you know, you watch something from the 80s, say, and a lot of times it's like shocking, like, oh, you can't say that. Like just things that I didn't realize how awful they were. And you watch it now and say, oh my gosh, what a horror show. And I was watching a TV show from the 80s and it was like joking that one person in this office was sick. And so they came to work with a cold and all sitting at the table, one person's sneezing and has tissues everywhere. And I'm like, what are you doing? This is just so rude. And it's so funny. At the time it was just like, oh, isn't it funny? Charlie's got a cold and just sneezing all over the workplace. I'm like,
it's like, no, nowadays 12 people were killed.
Right? Yeah. I can't even.
Yeah. Thanks, Charlie.
It was hard to watch. I was like, oh gosh. Yeah. so weird. I had no idea that would like trigger me so much. So.
Yeah, I went and got my first shot a couple weeks ago, and that was the largest group of people I had seen in over a year. Like there was a couple of hundred people around, and it was uncomfortable. Like, yeah, it felt very strange.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of the same for me. I got my first one like a week or so ago, and you know, at least you're in an environment where there are a lot of people who are kind of like aware of what to do. Mm-hmm. But
the place I'm going is a drive-through. You basically go down, you roll down your window, and they're maybe using a trank gun or something. I hope that'd be cool.
Yeah.
Just they say slow down, and start shooting at me. That's what I'm hoping for.
Yeah.
Yeah, they had me run through a field, and then they gave me a 10-minute head start, and then, yeah, I think it was a vaccine.
The most dangerous vaccination.
It hurt a lot, so I assumed it was a vaccine.
Assumed it was a vaccine.
It must have been effective, yeah.
I hallucinated for a few days. That's a normal symptom, right?
Yeah, it is funny to see also, like, television shows where you wouldn't normally think of this, but now you look at them and you think, oh, boy, they're all just smashed together. Yeah. Why are they so close together?
Yeah, I've heard pop culture critics now are using this term pandemic aware or not when talking about TV shows, like, because now, like, for the next 10 years, any show that's set any time in this period is going to have people walking around wearing masks, right?
Yeah.
Or, you know, so either they're doing that and it's pandemic aware, or they're set in 2020 and people are just pretending that it didn't happen and people are behaving normally. So that's sort of, which is a weird, surreal sort of thing.
I think there's supposed to be a remake of Speed, and you imagine that elevator scene's going to be, there's two people trapped in this elevator. What? They maxed out the elevator?
Each standing on their little dot on the floor.
Their little dots in the diagonal corners.
Okay,
this bus
let's see.
Has four people on it. It can't go faster than this. They've really lowered the terrorists are like, man, like, I can blow stuff up and nobody notices. Somebody on any of these things.
Continuing on in the feedback. So let's see. On the Facebook group, Lim Tae Chan, who has been a fairly active member of the Facebook group for a long time, he was looking for programs to watch after having finished up the Computer Chronicles and the computer program, and was sort of looking for, like, you know, old sort of TV programs to watch. And
ooh,
came across...
I have a recommendation.
Oh, do you?
What is it? Bits and Bytes from TV Ontario. And Bits and Bytes 2. Yes. With Luba Goy. Luba Goy, like, national treasure. And Billy Van, and just, like, it's period, it's awesome, it's informative. It's some of the best things Canada ever did. So Bits and Bytes and Bits and Bytes 2.
Canadian treasure that.
So one, like, Bits and Bytes, the original Bits and Bytes was like 1983 period, and Bits and Bytes 2 was like 1991. So they're two very different computer periods, and just delightful, absolutely delightful.
Excellent. Yeah.
Yeah.
The one that Lim Tae had found was what was called BBC Micro Live. And there are a few of the, I looked at a couple of episodes. There was a particular one that was linked to that. I don't know why I don't remember if this is the one he, oh yeah, that's right. I think he was commenting on there being, like, a lot of MSX computers, and that was surprising or something. But, so I clicked on the link. It turns out that the available videos are not all that great. There is, The one that we'll have a link to in the show notes actually is pretty badly out of sync audio video wise, which is a bit distracting. There does exist another version that is nicely in sync on the web, except that it's the resolution is really, 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 really terrible. So I think probably you can live with the out of sync one, but this one was very cool because they were talking a little bit about you know, the care of diskettes and having them sort of, like, you know, having to be careful of magnets and not touching them and stuff. And so they did a little segment on the, like, sort of, they tested this out. They took seven identical diskettes and they put them in all these different conditions. So they put one on the floor of a tube train because they heard that there was a lot of magnetic, you know, stuff on the tube. They put one in the freezer. They put one on by the monitor. They put one on a speaker and played Barry Manilow for a while.
The speaker's one I've always heard. Yeah.
Did they feed one to a crocodile? Because
they did not fly it as a kite.
That was an Apple II joke for the locals.
Yeah.
Well done.
But what else? So they put it through an airport X-ray baggage scanner, and the manufacturer apparently was so confident that this was not going to be a problem that they ran it through 1,000 times. And they soaked one in beer. And then they put one under a ringing phone. And then they checked to see, like, which ones would load. And it turned out that the only one, should I spoil it? the beer one was fine. The tube one was fine. The freezer one was fine. The only one that failed was the one that was under a phone. So
would have guessed the beer one would get, like, a weird film or something. I would have been sure that wouldn't work.
Yeah, it sort of, like, lost its horizontal hold.
Right. All the graphics are out of focus.
Right.
The bytes were still there, but they were all jerks.
Anyway, I thought it was pretty funny though. It's a neat show. Take a look at that, but I guess even more, take a look at Bits and Bytes.
And we've talked about this before, but those of us who grew up with that stuff now have this paranoia about magnets, and
yeah.
Because we all went through this period of learning all the things that have magnets in them that maybe you didn't know had magnets in them. And to this day, like I get nervous about putting an SD card down on top of a speaker or something like that. I there's this moment where I'm like, is this okay? I guess it is, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's weird. I have the same thing, like as if all media is magnetic media somehow.
Yeah.
Little bit of me always thinks that.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Although the thing is, you know, I am surrounded by, you know, these old computers with these old disk drives, you know, that take magnetic media, and yet I'm also surrounded by magnets now. I mean, everything is magnets.
Yeah.
My little AirPod case and my laptop has 9 magnets around the edge.
Yeah. I noticed the other day that I have this ruler on my desk, and I noticed the other day that my modern MacBook Pro will attract this thing from like 6 inches away. Like there are some crazy powerful magnets in a MacBook Pro on the front sides.
Yeah.
I don't know what, I think it's the speakers maybe, but it's alarmingly powerful. Like I was shocked by that.
Yeah. And you know, like I have many, many items on my desk now collect paperclips.
I guess we're in a magnet proof world now. So they're just putting crazy strong magnets in all kinds of stuff. Plus we have neodymium magnets now, which weren't a thing in the 80s. So magnets are literally a lot stronger now than they used to be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And nevertheless, you know, so I definitely worry about, you know, my Apple III there and the discs for it.
Yeah.
Because they have not become magnet proof.
Yeah, that's right. It's harder to keep them safe now than it was for sure. Yeah. Yeah, it used to be just basically speakers that you really had to worry about, but nowadays it's everything.
It's super easy to, like, you know, image a disc and put it down on that nice, you know, you have this like nice big flat area on your MacBook Pro, you know, where you can like put it down and like, you know, sort of copy down the information from it. And you want to make sure that you do that after you've made the image and not before.
Yeah. Or your MagSafe power connector or the little case that your AirPods come in, there's a little magnet in the lid of that thing. You put that on a floppy disk, maybe you ruin it.
Magnets everywhere. How do they work?
Yeah. I was wondering, how are we going to fit that in? Surely it's somehow.
I'll shoehorn it. There was a comment in the, we were talking about TV shows to watch. I don't know which user this is, but recommends the BBC Computer Literacy Project, which I think we talked about before, and I second that recommendation. So stick a link in the show notes. I think there's like an archive of that available, and I think it's only for a limited time, and it looks like it's still up at the moment, but it's eventually going to go away. So,
like all of this.
Yeah.
I'll mention one, maybe one, two more. So Tony wrote over email. He sent us a video. It's about texture archaeology. It's called The Most Overused Game Graphic You Never Noticed. And then it sort of goes through and talks about what it's basically doing is observing that there's this brick pattern, this cobblestone brick pattern that occurs in many, many, many different games from many different studios. It's kind of an identifiable pattern, and the video itself actually kind of goes through not just this but a bunch of things. You know, so there's talks a little bit about there's some game, actually people who know the games will probably know exactly what I'm talking about, but there's some game where I think Mario turns silver and reflective and at some point, and the games were not powerful enough at that point to actually do reflections, and so this was a sort of a static sort of reflected image, but you can see in the reflection, in his reflection, you can see this image, but it wasn't quite clear what it is an image of. And eventually this was discovered, you know, on I think some SGI workstation. There was a picture of some flowers that is the thing that was actually reflected in that. And you know, so people do this kind of detective work, but so this brick pattern, it turns out, is just in everything. You know, and so the video kind of goes through a discussion of, like, you know, trying to track down where it is. It's pretty interesting. It's done in a little bit of an overblown style. You know, have either of you seen, I think it's called American Vandal. It's like a mock crime, real crime documentary thing. It's relatively high budget, but it's set in like, it's basically, the premise is that it's like kids in high school, or maybe it's even junior high, you know, like making this real crime video about like who's put graffiti on the cars or whatever. This video has that same kind of like, you know, investigative journalist, overblown, feeling to it. But anyway, I don't know if I should spoil it, but, I mean, it's in the end, it's a little bit obvious. It was basically just a texture in a package that Autodesk bought. And so everybody sort of had easy access to it. And so the reason that it was everywhere was just because it was like the bricks that you had available to you. And of course it was, but it's still kind of interesting to see this having appeared all over the place.
Yeah, it reminds me a bit. There was a documentary that went around a while back about music, history of the breakbeat or something. And it was it's this like drum sequence that's in like all music basically, and it was like a built-in sequence in the Roland 808 or something, but it just became remixed and just became part of the culture. And now like it's a bit like the Wilhelm scream, like once you know it, you just hear it in everything. Whether that's a good thing or torture depends on how you feel about the Wilhelm scream. I lean more in the torture camp, but it's one of those things.
So a cool segue that ties together the idea of bricks and high school investigative stuff, which is Ryan Johnson's incredible movie Brick.
Oh yeah, yeah,
which
yeah.
Yes, so good.
If you didn't say it, I was going to. I think it's in my top three favorite movies, if not number
it's
one.
Unbelievably good. It's so people should see it. It's amazing. Stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and it's like a hard-boiled detective thing set in a high school. Yeah. It's incredible. It's so
written entirely in like 1920s gangster slang. And the dialogue, you have to watch it five times just to understand what they're saying in some of those scenes. But it takes itself super completely seriously.
Yeah, it plays it straight.
Except for one or two moments. the mother is serving them iced tea or whatever. Right.
Yeah, because when somebody outside of this world kind of comes into it, you see it for what it is. But it's so good. It is a hard-boiled detective murder mystery set in high school. Yeah. Incredible, incredible. So
hard
I recommend that.
For sure.
Yeah,
excellent.
As soon as you said high school, I'm like, Brick, high school? Oh.
Yeah.
I must mention this.
Yeah, you started talking about American Vandal. I'm like, is he talking about Brick? Because it sounds like Brick.
Okay, maybe I suppose I can leave it there. We have more such things to talk about in the items of interest in news anyway. So why don't we start that? And Carrington, you have the first one.
Again, on nice, YouTube. Real quick one. We've talked a few times in many shows in the past about painting things like an Apple II, painting cases and finding the right color to paint things. We've also talked about clear cases and lots of case things. But this is a video I stumbled across recently that was neat because it takes the TRS-80 bent. And so it's two videos, a part one and a part two. Actually, it's part one and the next video is like part two, three, four all together. And it's about how to paint a TRS-80 Model 3. And what I like about this is it goes through some stuff that if you've never painted a thing before, you might not know about some of the steps. So it talks about sanding, it talks about masking and what you would mask and how and where you'd mask parts on this case, and then just painting out. So it's nothing super complicated, but it's just like if you had a case that you for a TRS-80 Model 3 or 4, some same sort of idea, like how would you go about painting this if you want to look like new again? And it's a neat little set of videos where somebody just gets a case, takes it off the computer, talks about the various parts of it, masks off bits, sands things, paints, goes through like all those repetitive processes and ends up with a nice looking case. So it's kind of cool. So if you're interested in doing that, but really want like a kind of an intro to painting something, you're like, when do I use tape and sandpaper and why and stuff? This is the videos for you. So I liked it. So it's how to paint a Model 3 case, and it's a pair of videos on YouTube. So I'll have a link to the first of those, which will then, it'll be easy to find the second one after you watch the first. That's it. Nice, fast one.
Cool. Yeah, I just sort of like watching it go by, I'm struck by how light that case appears when he's like waving it around. As if
all
it
candy stuff is that
it
way.
Probably
it
does.
Looks super heavy in metal. My cocoa was just literally, if you didn't put something on it, would just float away. Like they look so substantial, but they're nothing. You know, the Model 3 and stuff with the, if it's got all the guts in there, that monitor is going to hold it down. But once you just have the plastic shell, they're quite light.
Yeah.
That's it. Paint your cases.
Okay.
Or not. Cool. Whatever. You do you.
So I came across this. I forget exactly how I came across this. That's interesting. I don't know. I don't remember now what it was that led me to this.
I do know because I was going to put the thing in the link, and then I saw you had a link to Retro 365 blog, and I'm like, oh, Paul's already got it. But now you're talking about something else. So.
Yeah. Okay. Hold on. Let me remind myself. Where did this come from? It was some of the feedbacks. Somewhere. Or maybe I pulled it down. Well, go ahead. Say the thing that I should have remembered.
I'm looking for the link now. I deleted it because I saw it was in this sheet already.
Because something led me to this blog, which then. Okay.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't even know this blog, but yeah. I like that the tagline is, let the fumes of yesteryear take you on a billowing journey.
Yeah.
I found it.
Oh, you did? Okay, yeah. So what was it that led us to this blog?
So it was a blog post that went around somewhere, maybe on Twitter, a post from that same site, Retro365, about an original copy of Sabotage. That's what I had. Is that what you were referring to?
No.
Oh.
I remember Sabotage.
Well, okay then.
Let's talk about Sabotage anyway. So Sabotage, I mean, like maybe we can talk about this. This is a blog post on this blog. Later I will say this is a cool blog.
Yes.
that I didn't know before this. But Sabotage is an early game by online software, which became Sierra Online. And this is one of those games that I'm sure we all knew. I mean, it's one of those games that everybody copied around to, GameDollar.
Yeah, I never saw a package for it, but I had the game.
Yeah, it was one of the first ones I ever played. And it's very collectible because despite the fact that everybody had it and everybody played it, I don't think all that many people bought it in the first place. It's from something like 1980, 1981, something like that.
Yeah, this jumped out at me because I certainly had never seen an original disc for Sabotage, and mm-hmm. this was one of those games, like it was a very small game. I mean, the whole game was 30K or something, so there was a copy of it on every compilation of pirated games that you ever had anywhere, and it was so widely pirated that as a kid, I didn't understand that it was a commercial product, like, because I had never seen it on a shelf, I'd never seen it in a magazine, and it was on every disc, so I just thought it was just like a giveaway or something. I didn't understand that it was a real commercial game that you were supposed to buy. That's how widely pirated it was. So it was cool to see an actual floppy in the actual instruction manual for it.
Yeah, and it's I learned a couple of things about this too. I didn't quite understand. So this is Mark Allen who wrote Sabotage, and this also is the same person who wrote Stellar Invaders for Apple as well. So. This apparently is, which was one of Apple's few forays into the game world. You know, so very early on, they had a Space Invaders game called Stellar Invaders, which was good. I mean, it was a good version of it. And then from there, Mark Allen had gone on to with Online Systems release Sabotage. Sabotage is, if somehow you don't know, and I mean, I guess if you weren't like an Apple II person, you may not have come across it, but it's essentially you're this little turret. You're this little like gun turret, and you what you can do is basically change the direction you aim, and then fire. And actually, there's a couple of cheats that you can do where like you can actually drive the bullets. Like if you it's not really a cheat. It's like an in-game option, but you can make it so that as you turn the turret, your bullet actually also follows that and makes it a little easier to hit the things that are coming at you, but all the little like the little helicopters that go by and drop little paratroopers, and there's this grisly thing you can do where you can shoot off the parachute of the paratrooper and they plummet to their death.
Yeah, it was an excellent little detail that you could do that. It was a genuinely good game. Like the animation in it is great, and there's the explosions are really nice. Like the controls feel good, and especially for an early game, a lot of people had paddles because joysticks weren't really a thing yet in like 79 or 80 or whenever this game came out. So it was a game you could play with a single paddle, which was really cool.
Yeah.
The helicopter blades animation is super choplifters. You see where choplifter got that.
Yeah, that helicopter sprite period is like, yeah, every Apple II helicopter looks like that. Yeah. I always found kind of neat.
Yeah. So the blog itself is Ernst Krogtoft in Copenhagen is basically just kind of going through his collection, I guess, of this is primarily old Apple II stuff, but it does sort of refer to other platforms as well when it's relevant. And basically it's sort of nice photographs of the things that he's got and little histories about them. It is interesting to see some of these ones that really are rare, you know, and very nicely photographed. This is, I mean, I think part of what I like about this is that I want to do this. I want to make a blog like this.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I did not know about this blog, so I will be reading through this.
Yeah, the layout and the graphic design, it's beautiful. Like everything about it is really beautiful.
Yeah, so it's just at retro365.blog for people listening at home.
And there is a YouTube channel that sort of, it basically just accompanies the blog post. So it's embedded video in a blog post, but it exists on YouTube. So you could, you know, see them separately if you wanted to. But anyway, so if you haven't taken a look at that, go take a look at that. And perhaps I will return to this at some point when I figure out what it was that actually led me to which post it was that I wanted to feature. But at any rate, it's quite interesting. And it's actually had a lot of recent additions, like within the last month or something. Actually, April 25th today. In fact, there was a blog post here, so it looks like it's active. So there may well be many more posts by the time this actually hits the RCR podcast feed.
The Apple II Goonies game that is on the screen right now is that game is excellent. If anyone on the Apple II has not played the Goonies game, I think it was on the Commodore 64 and other platforms as well. It looks like it was on MSX as well. But yeah, that game is actually surprisingly good. You'd think for a movie knockoff it would be terrible, but it's actually really good.
It's also one of my favorite arcade games. It was on the Nintendo, the Red Tent. So you play it on that because it's basically a Nintendo 64 or a Nintendo NES game. And it's amazing. It's one of my absolute favorite arcade games. If I walk in an arcade and they have it, I will always play it. I just love it.
I did not know that was an arcade game.
And I don't think I've ever played it. So I guess I better.
And it's available on MAME, so you can check it out. Great music. Really, really fun. It's one of those games, though, that you put in multiple quarters because it's basically a time-based thing, and you cannot finish this game. So it's like, well, you got there. You'll either die or just run out of time, put in more quarters. But fantastic, fantastic game in the arcade.
I guess that's it for my thing. Quinn, you have the next thing.
Yeah, so let's see if I can share this. So this was a neat little article. It came up on Hackaday, but we'll link to the original article in the show notes because that's nicer. So this is someone who has gotten a vintage Mac display to work on a modern Mac. So it's like a 90s era. I think it's a Performa something or other. It's from like the LC era. And he's gotten it to work on his modern Mac. And it's a pretty surprisingly challenging thing. This is something that I hadn't really thought about, but in hindsight, it's obvious, I guess, that Macs from the 90s all had like proprietary video, you know, in a way that 90s computers often did, but we don't really think about it. You know, you bought a Mac and it came with a monitor and you used that monitor and you didn't think too much about it. Mm-hmm. But that monitor was actually a weird custom standard for the most part. It was usually VGA based. But what he talks about in some detail in this blog post is that the sync signals are all different, even among different Macs. So some of them used, so VGA had separate horizontal and vertical sync signals. So there's two pins on the connector for that. Some Macs did use that. A lot of Macs, so other Macs used sync on green, where the two horizontal and vertical sync pulses are combined and fed into the green. SGIs and some other systems did that as well. But there was a whole generation of Macs or whole group of Macs that used a thing that nobody else did, which was composite sync. So the sync signals were combined like sync on green, but they were on a dedicated pin. And the interesting thing was the monitors between different 90s Macs were relatively intercompatible because the computers were generating all the signals. So whatever weird signals the monitor you plugged in needed, they were there. So that DB15 Mac video connector that was the standard for so long, that has separate sync pulses. If you have a VGA-like monitor, it'll do sync on green. The pulses are on the green, and the pulse, and there's an extra pin that's the composite sync for those that combine the sync but on a different pin. So the monitor that he has wants the composite sync, and there's no commercial way to generate that signal from, you know, VGA adapters or anything like that, because, you know, a handful of 90s Macs were the only things that synced that way. So what he's done is figured out how to take this separate VGA horizontal and vertical syncs and combine them with a little breadboard circuit into a composite sync that he can then feed to this monitor. So it's pretty cool. I learned a lot about 90s Mac video in this post, and he gets it working. As you can see, it's black and white only. He couldn't get the color working. He doesn't actually say why, but he just may not have tried, because once he got the sync working, that was kind of the hard part. It's actually surprisingly cool. He goes into all the details. And I also learned about this tool for modern Mac OS X called Switch Res X, and it allows you to output video of any sync frequency that you want. So, you know, with a modern Mac, you're limited to a couple of default or a couple of hard-coded settings, a couple of resolutions and a couple of refreshes and stuff. There's this tool that will let you actually spit out video from your Mac that has any combination of refresh and resolution and so on that you want. Kind of like how old Windows used to do that too, where you could just type in all the numbers that you wanted. So this tool is also very cool that I didn't know it existed. So if you want to talk to vintage displays, this tool seems like it would do a lot of that for you. So that's it for this item.
Excellent. And actually, I did locate what it was that led me to the Retro 365 blog, which is something that we didn't quite cover in the topic. But I was looking for information about Graphics Magician, which was a way that you could write old games contemporary to, you know, the regular Apple II development. This is one of the first things that I bought. I bought Graphics Magician and I bought Arcade Machine because there was a plan. But anyway, so he's got a very nice write up of Penguin Software stuff. Anyways, that's how I came across this, because I was looking for information about Graphics Magician.
It's worth explaining that to listeners who may not be familiar. Graphics Magician was, because it was very iconic of like very early Apple II software. A lot of commercial software used it for creating static images. It was a vector drawing package that achieved very high compression, basically by just storing vertices and fill patterns and so on. And so that meant, of course, that the graphics had to be rendered at runtime. And so you would see the scenes draw. You know, it was very common.
And then that weird fill that would start in the middle and go like one direction, then another direction.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was very iconic. And so you'd see a lot of adventure games that used images drawn in Graphics Magician. And it was often a giveaway, because they would draw objects that were interactable as a separate layer. And so you would see the scene draw, and then you'd see like the little piece of paper draw at the end, and
right.
You'd know that was an object that could be picked up because of the way it drew.
All right, let's see. Carrington, yes, you have the next thing.
I do indeed. There was a game called Castle Quest. There's a few games called Castle Quest, but the one from 1980 has been found, and found in an interesting way. Now, this was a game that you played online through Genie, The Source, and CompuServe. It existed on all three of those. And so when you read different discussions and different people have been looking for this, they'll often refer to it as a CompuServe game or a Genie game. It was actually on all three of them. It was created by two fellows, Michael Holtzman and Mark Kirschenblatt. And then it was published and ported by a fellow named Bob Maples. So it's sometimes referred to as a Bob Maples game, but he was just the publisher. So this was an adventure game that was created in Fortran and thought lost. Nobody knew where the source code was. And then somebody realized the authors of the game had gone to taken kind of an unnecessary step, but not a bad one, to ensure their copyright. And something in America is automatically copyrighted when you create it. But to make sure they had their claim, they sent a copy of the source code printed out to the copyright office, and so got a copyright number, and somebody realized with that number, that means something is on file. So they were able to convince one of the two authors to go and ask for a copy back, which you can do if you're the submitting person. They got back the printout, and then it has now been scanned. First they tried OCR, didn't work at all. Somebody sat down and just typed it all out again, and has recreated the source code for this thing. Of course, it wouldn't compile. It's a super old version of Fortran, and but they're so now there's a version that does compile, and you can go on GitHub and get that. And people are now working on to kind of a little more modernize it or whatever. So this game thought completely lost was found in a really neat way. Like somebody realized, hey, there's going to be a printout of the source code, and mm-hmm. that's where they went and found it. So I love the kind of the story behind it. So we'll have links to both the initial story where it's Castle Quest exhumed, and so that it was found, and which is a description of the game, and it was basically a door game, an adventure game, just like Adventure. You could pay the various versions of Adventure on Genie. This was in the Genie Games area as just another one of those called Castle Quest. But it's now been found. And if you remember that from a kid, if you used to play it on CopyServe or whatever, you can play it again. So I'll have a link to both the original article about it being found, a link to the struggles they've gone through to try to get it compile, and the fact that it's now compiling, and the questions they kind of had about this weird version of Fortran. And what's neat is the fellow who's working on this was looking at the parts with the data that were saying to write it. And they said, like, why are they all starting with like a zero and then a space, or not a zero and a space? And his mom was an old Fortran programmer. When he said it, she goes, oh yeah, that's going to be, if it starts with a zero, it means do a new line and then put it. And that's what it does. So her vague memory from doing Fortran back in the 70s totally clued him into how to read the source code, which I thought was excellent. And I will have a link to the GitHub repository as well if you want to download it and play. So mm-hmm. I love it. I love how it was found. I love this guy's mom had to give him a clue. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah, it is pretty. It's quite a cool story.
Yeah.
And it sounded like the author didn't remember actually having submitted the source code. Thought it was just like a run through or whatever.
Right. But they were thinking maybe it was just some documentation or whatever. But they kept prompting, why don't you get a copy? Why don't you get a copy? Turns out it was a whole printout of the source code.
Very cool.
Yeah. So I wonder how many other things might be found because people now realize that this is a thing you can do. Like look up, was it copyrighted? Does it have an issuing number from the copyright office? And if so, get the original person who put it in to ask for a copy back, which you can do. And who knows what will be found that was once lost. So I think it was neat. Yeah, it's so funny. Jeremy in the chat says it's amazing that copyrights did something useful towards preservation. It's like, yeah, that's got to be a first. Usually it's the exact opposite. So yeah, so it's been found again due to copyright. Who knew? As a fairly anti-copyright person, I'm like, hey, wow, look, it did some good. Used its power for good.
Okay, the next thing we have is Quinn's.
So yeah, this is kind of a neat hyper-local story, and by that I mean me. it's too bad Blake's not here so I could thank him, because he tweeted recently that there's a pre-order open for Ian Kim, the South Korean wonder, who every so often comes out of nowhere with these crazy Apple II accessories. So he announced a pre-order for the Mockingboard 4C+, which so it's a Mockingboard that fits inside the Apple IIc+. Which, you know, speaking of niche markets, there's like six people in the world who want this, and I'm three of them. So, this pre-order was open very briefly, and I jumped in there and mashed buy. And I've just gotten an email from him that it has shipped. So I will be soon receiving a Mockingboard that will go inside my 2C+. So this is a modification. He has one for the regular 2C as well, called the Mockingboard 4C, obviously enough. Mm-hmm. And I don't know exactly how it works. It's one of these things that replaces the CPU, so it plugs in and then to the CPU socket, and then you put your CPU in the card. And obviously there's no slots in there to plug into, so it's sort of faking it that way. But I'm pretty excited about it. So once I get it running, I will definitely be sharing that with folks here.
Very cool.
Yeah. And like all his stuff, it wasn't that expensive. It looks amazing. Like this guy is just
I know, right? He just pops out of nowhere every once in a while with just like, hey, this. Yeah. He's like, what?
Yeah.
Crazy. Yeah. Oh, I had missed this completely. That's very cool.
Yeah.
So pre-orders on this are closed. You can't currently get them. He has a store. If people are wondering where to buy his stuff generally, he's on eBay. He has an eBay storefront. But he does not have this listed on his eBay storefront right now. So maybe he's gauging demand, or maybe he's tooling up, or I'm not sure, but yeah.
Yeah, I might consider this. My 2C Plus is my sort of tricked out machine. It's overclocked, and it's, I guess I don't, oh, I don't, I think I have, you know, the special ROMs to put in it, but I don't, haven't put them in yet. I wonder where they are. Carrington, you found them in your, Kansas Fest lanyard, right?
I did indeed. I took Quinn's ROM in my lanyard for Kansas Fest. I was going, I'm like, hey, oh, that's where it is.
Well, speaking of which, so yeah, since we're talking about 2C plus modifications, so mm-hmm. yeah, I did. I made the Megabeep ROM some years ago, and before anyone emails me, no, I don't have any more of them, and no, I don't plan to make any more of them. But it was a ROM that defaults the 2C plus to 1 megahertz and fixes the beep sound, so it sounds more like a regular Apple II. And the funny story about this is, out of nowhere, I got an email a couple of days ago. From someone who has it, and it turns out there is an incompatibility with this ROM. So, yeah, what? So this ROM, I mean, it does a very, very tiny change in the ROM, so I couldn't imagine it would cause any software to break, but it goes to show that software compatibility is hard, especially on something like the Apple II, where it existed for 10 years, and as we were saying before, it was essentially a static platform.
Yeah, I thought you were talking about how, ooh, you target old computers and run forever. Well, huh, that yeah. lasted an hour.
So the flip side of a static platform is that everybody exploits every little weirdsy in that platform, right? So if you touch a single byte in ROM, someone was checking that byte. So what's interesting here is that the game that broke is Where in America's Past is Carmen Sandiego? So the takeaway is that A, the tiniest ROM change can break something, and B, there were way more Carmen Sandiego games than I even knew about. I had never heard of this one. But apparently it was a very late one, and what it does is it actually checks for the 2C plus and turns off the accelerator itself.
Oh.
And that's why it breaks with my ROM. So the person who wrote to me, I think he said, I can't remember if he said the game won't boot or if the game gets confused and it turns the accelerator back on or something like that, one of those two things. But in any case, the game doesn't work properly, so that has to be the only game in existence that actually is 2C plus aware. I've never heard of any other software that does something like that. Mm-hmm. But it was pretty cool.
That's cool. So, we were talking earlier about how if you want to write old software, it's hard to stay motivated or whatever. One motivation could be to write software that breaks Quinn's ROM.
Yeah.
Like, that right. could sustain me for a long time through a development process. Just be able to send bug things to Quinn. Ooh, broke it again.
Very nice.
Yeah, what one thing I've learned from following 4AM on Twitter is how many games don't work on the 2E from earlier just because they were checking one byte in the ROM or whatever that changed in the 2E or, you know, how much incompatibility there actually was. And a lot of those games were re-released, you know, they were patched once, you know, there's games that don't work on the Platinum 2E that work on all other 2Es,
oh,
you know,
my goodness.
Things like that. Yeah, and they all got patched quietly, you know, so if you bought the game from a store after the Platinum 2E came out, it worked and you were none the wiser. But now because of that there's like 10 versions of some of these games out there that were all quietly patched, but they're different.
Bought the game? You could buy Apple II software?
Apparently, I don't know.
The things I learned. My goodness.
Apparently, it was sold in stores. I don't know. All right. Yeah, so that's it for that item.
Cool.
And I... totally didn't notice that I had a line in there that got alphabetically skipped, but it's not actually all that much that I need to say. Robert Noyce, who got the patent for the integrated circuit, got that patent 60 years ago today as we record. So there you go.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah. It does seem like it was kind of a long time ago, but this person is was kind of a big deal. Yeah, so co-founded Fairchild Semiconductor, went off to Intel Corporation after, got the patent for the monolithic integrated circuit, or microchip that makes all of this possible.
So, I don't think he just went off to Intel. I think he was also one of the founders of Intel, wasn't he? Yep, was one of the founders of Intel in 1968.
Amazing.
Like you said, kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
I didn't know Intel was founded that early. Wow.
The particular tie to this date is a little tenuous. You know, it's when the patent was granted, but nevertheless. Noyce and Gordon Moore founded Intel in 1968. I assume that's more of Moore's Law.
Which was, I believe, you will found companies at an exponential rate.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's what happens. So anyway, very nice. Yeah, and
well done.
Yeah, great.
Congrats.
Sorry about the arm thing.
Yeah. Let's see, where was it? So I guess they left Shockley Semiconductor. Like I was a little nervous when I looked at Noyce's background. Like, you know, was this actually a monster who did great things? But no, I think he was all right. Shockley was the one monster.
Right.
So he left Shockley's labs, and that's good. All right. So now a word from our sponsor.
The Amstrad 8256 is a complete word processor. It has a big 256K memory, a high-resolution monitor with built-in disk drive, and inclusive word processing software, as well as a fully integrated printer. Yet it costs just £399 plus VAT. When you update the office, shouldn't you make room for one? The Amstrad 8256. More than a word processor for less than most typewriters.
And we're back. So the next thing is the host's retrocomputing gift idea. And the retrocomputing gift idea this time is a book called Crackers Won the Gold Rush. This missed my radar entirely. I did not even know that this was going to appear, but apparently it is book one of a two-book project. I don't really know what the status is of the second book, but it's basically a book about software piracy in the 80s and 90s. And it looks really nice. It's a hardbound book in English, although it's being published in and shipped out of Germany. And it has 336 brilliant color pages. It has lots of interviews with interviews and photos and about the piracy scene, both in the U.S. And in Europe. And so I think it'll be pretty interesting. I think most of the people who have experience with this scene don't have experience with either the U.S. or the European scene. So it'll be sort of interesting to see. But there are lots of interviews with, it looks like, software houses, as well as people who are involved in the piracy end. So it looks really interesting. Former code breakers on Apple II, BBC Micro, Sinclair Spectrum, Amstrad, CPC, C64, Amiga, and especially our Atari ST reveal the truth of a unique computer youth.
Yeah, when I looked at the thumbnails, it looked like it was just going to be a book about Commodore 64 crack screens, sort of the early demo scene that came out of crack screens. But it's interesting how in the text it looks like it's actually much, much more than that. It covers many platforms and the whole culture of cracking and not just the demos and intros and so on. The photography is beautiful. Especially like the Commodore 64 screenshots. Like I've never honestly been a fan of Commodore 64 graphics. I find the colors very muddy and strange, but the photography in this book actually makes it all look quite nice.
Yeah. And it does look like there's even, some technical details about how protections worked and were cracked and stuff like that. I mean, like it does, I'm expecting it to be quite interesting to read.
Yeah, perhaps this is my North American bias, but I wonder if they will undercover Apple II copy protection and cracking in general because it was much more of a North American thing, and also in this book's coming out of Germany, and also because it's easily a topic that could have five books of its own. Like I think people from other platforms don't necessarily appreciate the depth and breadth of Apple II copy protection. It was much different than other platforms in the way that it worked, but I'd be very interested to see this anyway.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's not not super expensive. It is 35 euros down. Like I guess this is maybe it's on sale from 40, but at any rate, international shipment between 21 and 60 days.
But also it's 1.3 kilograms. That's like almost 3 pounds. That's a hefty book.
It looks like it comes in a box. Am I understanding this right? Or what?
I do not know.
Well, presumably there'd be two versions. So there'd be this lovely printed version, and there'd also be an authentic version, which is just going to be a photocopy missing a bunch of pages and with somebody else's name scrawled on the front for a true cracking experience.
Right.
It looks like there's some kind of box set or something. I'm not sure, because there's a picture of a box further down that looks like it contains the book. And there's a quote from Tim Schafer on the back that I like. He says, "The fame of Monkey Island may be entirely due to software piracy." Which is, presumably alludes to comparing the number of people who played it compared to the number of sales they actually had, because a lot of these games that are such cult hits now sold very poorly back in the day, which means almost nobody was playing a legal copy of them.
Yeah,
that's a joke with Infocom games, that sometimes the InvisiClues would outsell the game itself.
Yes, by right. Impressive margins, yeah.
And now I guess we can move on to eBay once we're done buying that, and Carrington has the first eBay auctions.
Just a little thing caught my eye. This I thought was cute because it's just a cassette of Apple leading the way, and it's just an internal cassette. And so presumably this is the audio from that relatively famous video that is basically an Apple internal promotion thing ripping off completely the What a Feeling song from Flashdance. Mm-hmm. And it's like, lead the way. It's hilarious. So that video is available on YouTube. We'll put a link in the show notes. But I haven't seen this before, which is just an audio cassette. And I'm guessing it's just that song. And it's weirdly all packaged up. So is this something they just gave away internally to promote to people? I don't know. I don't know why this thing exists. But I'm assuming it's just that song.
Yeah, like to be played in stores or something. That's what a feeling. Strange. Yeah, you can see how short the tape is from the photo.
Yeah.
It's like a single size or length of tape there. So yeah, it must just be that song.
Right.
Yeah, maybe it's for dealers to play in the stores.
So is it just the one song? I don't know. I hope whoever gets this ridiculously for $130. Like, oh my gosh. That's the starting bid. So I guess they're not going to be motivated to just like rip the audio and stick it online so the rest of us can hear, but I hope it gets preserved. I'd like to know what's on this cassette, but I'm guessing it's just that Fame ripoff song that Apple used, because Fame came out in 1983, big hit, 1984, Apple's using it internally to motivate people. And it's just like, you know, you get in an elevator, you hear a Muzak version of a song, you're like, I kind of know the song, that's that thing, but it's the Fame song. It's shameful, or shameless anyway. It's something to ashamed. I'm not that familiar with Shane.
Yeah, it's a neat artifact. That price is a little steep, though.
Yeah, big time. So that's why, Paul, I'm not trying to push this on you. But if you were to buy it, that's fine. I'm just saying. Probably shouldn't.
Okay.
I just liked it because I hadn't seen it before. I didn't know this existed as a cassette.
Yeah, no, I don't think I have not come across this before either.
You don't have two of them?
I do not.
I thought it was a chance. Maybe you go, I got that. I got a pile of them. That's what I got. Just that's it. Nothing else caught my eye.
Okay. Let's see. I will
begin your list of 30 things.
No. Well, it's not super.
What do you
many.
Got this time?
So the first one I have is I've listed as a perfect gift for the Mac enthusiast who you don't like very much. So let's see if I can find the screen that has
what
it
is
in
Quinn
here.
Getting me for Christmas.
Yeah. It is a lot of 7 Macintosh DVI video adapters.
Oh my gosh.
I sort of think of this as like, you know, I've been trying to get rid of these.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I just keep multiplying.
Yeah, I have a box of those and I have no idea where they came from. I've never bought one.
Nope.
Yeah.
Because, there's the full-size DVI and the DVI to VGA and the mini DVI and, like, all these various things. And you'll never have the exact one you need.
Yeah, no.
All these others. Yeah.
You still can't get the overhead projector to work.
Right, exactly. it's not actually being sold for very much. I mean, if you wanted to buy it now for $15, you could, or you could bid on it for $5. But so it's not – no one's trying to gouge you, but it was just an amusing thought that somebody would want these. Okay, let's see. The next thing I have, this is a sealed copy of Times 2, which is was a Mac program. It's advertised as double your disk space without compressing files.
So like disk doubler.
Yeah, basically. It is from Golden Triangle. Let's see if I can make this big enough to see.
I don't know this at all.
Golden Triangle is the company. And it has a list of features. The features are, you know, so it lists them in kind of a weird way. But so the first column is a list of check marks, and then the other columns are the sort of less impressive check marks for auto doubler and disk doubler, two things that similarly did this kind of thing. So what auto doubler and disk doubler both did, I think, was basically just kind of hooked into the finder or whatever. And so like if you wanted to like use a file, it's basically it's a little bit like what cloud documents does now, actually, I think, or Dropbox, the Dropbox in the cloud documents, where it basically detects that you want to use a file and then unpacks it on the fly, or in Dropbox's case, downloads it. So that's what AutoDoubler and DiskDoubler did. This says x2 expands your disks up to twice the original size, something that AutoDoubler and DiskDoubler do not do. AutoDoubler and DiskDoubler compress your files. x2 lacks a checkbox.
So this does that without compressing? How does it do it then?
So yeah, that's basically all of this basically just says
it hacks the window to pretend you have more space than you do.
Yeah, I don't understand. It says essentially that the way it works is it makes your disk twice as big. It doesn't compress things, and I don't
right
understand
between the lines.
Maybe it's disingenuous marketing, like it compresses sectors instead of files or something, because they keep saying doesn't compress files. Well, it's compressing something else, probably.
Maybe that's it. Yeah, because it basically just seems like snake oil, basically. It's like,
but
a
so
cure-all.
I remember the first time I didn't understand virtual memory or paging out things at all, the first time I encountered RAM doubler. And so I'm told that this software will suddenly mean you have twice as much RAM. I'm like, whatever. And I saw it, I'm like, how? It just blew young Carrington's brain. Because yeah. I did not understand. So maybe there's just something going on here I don't understand.
Yeah, I'm curious. So neither of you had experience with this particular...
Never heard of it.
No, okay. I used auto doubler, but I
used disk doubler and then auto doubler
and RAM doubler actually, but not never heard of this.
Yeah, well, maybe I'll look into that. I am curious because it does seem it seems like it's just making magical claims. I don't understand. Okay, let's see. Next thing I had. So this is a set of ZX80, ZX81, Timex Sinclair 1000 stuff. It starts at $500. Basically, it's a pretty large starting bid coming out of Delaware. So to me, it's shipping is like $18, which is might be kind of low for this. But and what it is basically is so it looks like it's two Timex Sinclair computers, ZX80 that's has seen better days. It has a corner chipped off of it, a ZX81, some like a RAM expander, a couple of printers, and actually kind of a large number of cassettes and things. Looks like some of these are for the 2068, actually. So, which I don't think is included in this auction.
Books, posters, yeah, and a bunch of things.
That's so more Timex Sinclair printers than I've ever seen in one place.
Oh, you should see my shelves. But yeah, no, it's true. The printers are, I think I have a couple of rolls of paper for them too, but the printers are pretty easy to find. Actually, it turns out that like if you want a thing, it will come with a printer.
Interesting. I never saw one. It just seems like such a useless accessory for a vaguely useless computer that it never occurred to me that people bought them.
Yeah.
It's funny. I had a ZX80 or like a Canadian version of one. I've yet to see the actual case that I had as a kid for a while. And I didn't have a printer for it, but I did. I think I've talked to this show before. I did have one of those small format printers for my Coco. What a useless printer. And it took four little pens. So it actually drew. I'm kind of fond of it now, but at the time I was like, this is the worst printer in the history of printing. It's a pox upon me, this printer. Yeah.
So anyway, I don't know exactly what I think about this. So the Timex Sinclair 1000s are not, that is not the selling point of this auction. The ZX80s are in fact hard to come by. It's sad that this is cracked.
But this is a really rough looking ZX80 though.
Yeah.
Like, does it even work?
Well, who knows? I mean, did they ever?
How would you know?
But I mean, the fact that it has all of these tapes and manuals and stuff. I mean, like, I think this is really it's priced right on the edge. You know,
I think
like,
it's a little pricey.
It's on the high end of, you know, yeah, maybe if you're really a purist or a completionist ZX mm-hmm. Spectrum or Timex Sinclair collector, maybe all those books would be nice. But
yeah,
Mr. Johnny Blue Jeans in the chat is saying it's ZX80. None of this
it's a British computer,
this
so nope.
Canadian show.
Yeah, and it's a British computer, so nope. Yeah.
Even if it wasn't, I'm a Z boy. So I get how it would sound wrong to your ear. I think if you're used to it the other way.
That's actually why I say ZX80, because it sounds weird. Because when you hear people talk about them, it would, you know, they say ZX80, they don't say ZX80. So even though it's a Z80 processor.
Well, and as Canadians, we always call them the Timex Sinclair, right? Because we had that other, that differently branded version of it. I know the one you mean, Carrington, because a friend of mine had one as well. And mm-hmm. I would go over to his house and we'd like write a basic program by poking at the membrane. And then and then we were bored. Like that was all it did. It's like you could tint print hello. And then it was, its usefulness had expired.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, yeah. So, I agree. I think it could have maybe made it up to this point. I think starting it at this point is a little rough.
Probably a lower starting bid could have got that. Yeah. I guess it's. You just wonder what the audience for this. Somebody who really wants this stuff but doesn't have any of it. And,
Well,
and the ZX Spectrum has a rabid fan base, but these earlier ones, not really, right? Like, are there anyone who's that excited about these?
I don't know. I would not mind having them.
Somebody's excited about everything.
I suppose.
Yeah, that's right. And his name is Nick. Okay, anyway.
They're gathered upside down. Now down with Nick. Nick must go.
Okay, continuing on the Timex Sinclair stuff. This is now for the 2068, which is the it's kind of like the American version of the Spectrum, except that it's not Spectrum compatible. but it has sort of Spectrum-like attributes. It's a color Timex Sinclair. But anyway, so this is basically it's a thing that you can plug into your Timex Sinclair 2068 that allows you to plug in an RGB to HDMI device that's made for Sega Genesis console. So essentially, what it is, it's basically a thing that gives you HDMI output. By requiring that you get a different thing that gives you HDMI output, which I think was kind of amusing.
Okay, I didn't even know there was a Sega Genesis HDMI converter.
That's kind of amazing, actually. Yeah. So this adapts a Timex Sinclair to a Genesis adapter, which then gets you HDMI.
So there's a place you can plug in the Genesis end.
But
on this thing.
There's it shows two screenshots showing the difference in like the display quality, and it's remarkable.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's quite possibly worth it, even if it feels circuitous.
Yeah.
In possibly a punny way.
I know a lot of people have used like SCART connectors for things. Like when there's harder ways to get to the bigger hoops people have jumped through. Smaller hoops.
Yeah.
There's other hoops that have been jumped through.
That's right.
Hoops of some sort. It's hoops everywhere.
Well, it sounds like this Genesis adapter is like a secret retro tool that we're underappreciating. Like, apparently, it's got like some sort of RGB signals going into it that's easy to generate, and it generates HDMI, which is the hard part.
Yeah.
So I bet you could use this Genesis adapter for all sorts of retro uses.
Yeah, and there are a few brands. I think there are three. One is called Pound, and this one is what is it called? Level Hike. And there was one other one, but basically any of those would work with this device, you know, because it's making your Timex Sinclair 2068 look like a Sega Genesis.
That's cool. That's like a 50-year jump in technology. Mm-hmm. That's pretty funny to get HDMI out of a Timex Sinclair.
Yep. Cool.
Yeah, actually, the I wonder if you could plug it into a like a ZX80. Because I mean, you know, that's really pushing it.
Yeah,
it's an upscaler.
Anyway, it's not
to 5K.
$25 for the adapter, and then another 30-ish for the one the Genesis one. So, okay, next one. I thought this was this. I don't know why this came, actually, I do know why this came up. It was a description error listing, but this is a pin that has a barcode on it that reads human. Like if you read the, if you actually scan the barcode, it reads the ASCII, you know, H-U-M-A-N. So in case, you know, what is it? In case heaven goes computer, this button will help you pass under the light. I don't know what this means. It does feel like it's kind of like a joke made by somebody at church.
Yeah. This is a very strange thing.
Okay. So I guess on the back, it shows that it actually encodes 08211301114, which I guess in ASCII or whatever they're saying is going to be the word human.
Yeah, I guess it's probably the control characters, you know, backspace, forward space, return. But
weird dad who thought of this joke and like made 100 of these buttons for his friends or something, I feel like.
I think that's quite right. You have to have a Lazar pen in order to scan it.
Lazar. And it doesn't, of course, print out human. It prints out those numbers, which then you have to know are ASCII. Like, this is so much effort for this joke that isn't very good.
That's right. Well, I thought my joke in the show notes was pretty good, which I called it an early captcha.
Oh, right.
Your joke is much better than the joke that this button is going for.
Yeah. The reason it came up is that it says rare apple at the end, and the description says it's a Trona attaché pin. So it's mishmashed all different ways. Because I was searching for the Trona attaché. I was going to say something about that, but this came up, and I thought this was better.
Wow, that's a strange sequence of events that led you to that.
That's right. I just went over to the shelf and grabbed one of the few collectible things I have, almost nothing. I've got from, we talked about these ages before. This is my little boycott Radio Shack turns me off pin.
I have the same pin. How did we both end up with that pin?
We talked about it on an early RCR.
Was there two available from that same seller?
I was like, okay, I went on and grabbed it. And it's one of the few things I've kept, my little Radio Shack turns me off boycott pins. Power to the people.
Yeah.
I love wearing that and explaining it to people. It's like, well, it was for the Radio Shack strike in Canada of 1979. Everyone's like, I mean, they stopped listening, of course, but it's a lot to explain.
Yeah. Maybe I'll jump one here. This was also just, I think this was just tweeted like today or yesterday or something.
Yeah.
John Romero is selling some pillows that are shaped like Doom shareware floppies. So I was looking for retro competing gift ideas, and this probably isn't a good candidate since it's like a one-off, but they're expensive by now.
And it's worth mentioning just for 4AM's tweet, he replied to John Romero that he will take one, and if he likes it, he'll promise to pay you later.
That's right. Yeah. Already up to $127.50 after 24 bids. But... okay, let's see. The other thing that I have, this actually ties into the word from our sponsor. This is a Schneider Joyce, which is the European version of the Amstrad PCW 8256, which is
better than the typewriter.
Yeah, it's basically just a computer. It's like a Z80 computer, runs CPM, bunch of stuff. But for some reason, they were marketed as basically typewriter replacements. So it wasn't the fact that it was a computer was not a thing. You know, it had a printer, it had disk drives built into it. They used these sort of long 3-inch floppies, very weird looking things. And the models were 8256 and 8512. And then in Europe, they were marketed as the Joyce. So if you wanted to actually get one of these things, this is a Joyce. It's, I think, coming out of Cairo. It's shipping from Cairo. So it's actually not ridiculously expensive, I think, for what it is. It's a little under $200, but it's, to me at least, it would be another $200 to ship it. But it looks pretty complete. The thing comes on. You know, it looks, I don't know, it doesn't look terrible. So anyway, I think it's kind of interesting, at least.
It's got the box and everything. That's certainly an odd duck, that thing.
Yeah. So this is the 256K version of it. There's another PCW 8512 that's on eBay, which is this one.
For $25,000.
$25,000. It has not been opened.
Oh, so, I like how the show does you say it's potentially, just... potentially an 8512 or yeah. a box.
Yeah, either that or it's like someone's, you know, whatever, winter coats.
Yeah.
So, anyway, there is a make offer button. There are 7 people watching it, so who knows? but yeah.
That does make me think, though, about... So, I think we're all sort of computer snobs by default, but there was a whole generation of word processors that mm-hmm. most of us probably never saw, and I only kind of vaguely know about them because my sister used one for many years. Like, into the 90s, you could still buy these things that looked like typewriters that had like a 1 or 2 line LCD display on them, and they were a single purpose device, and they were like a little right. mediocre word processor. And a lot of people who, you know, like my sister, who were late adopters to computers and, you know, didn't want to necessarily get into them but needed a word processor for school, used those things. And so there was hundreds of models of them. I'm sure maybe someone out there collects them, but it's a strange little dark corner of retro computing that you don't hear mm-hmm. much about.
Yeah, and I definitely feel snobbish toward them. I mean, it's yeah. like, what is this?
My sister relentlessly for using that thing because it was just clearly worse than every computer I've ever owned. But, right. you know, she was more comfortable with it. Like, she was a typewriter person, and then this was, like, just a teeny bit more than a typewriter. It was a typewriter where she could, you know, fix spelling on the mm-hmm. line before hitting print and things like that. And that was all she really wanted. And,
so and didn't her, want the complexity of a full computer. Yeah. It's weird. Yeah. I mocked them too, but I now see how there was absolutely a market for them that was best filled by those things.
Yeah. It was yeah. a tiny little baby step towards computing for mm-hmm. a lot of people. Yeah.
Yeah. But what's kind of weird about this is that, this is an actual computer, you know. I mean, like, yeah. like this one isn't
supposedly
one of
better
those.
Than a word processor.
Yeah, it's got a CRT and everything, which is quite elaborate for yeah, this well, market.
And it runs, you know, Tetris.
Oh wow, it's got games and everything. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it can run CPM, you know, stuff.
Oh, CPM. Okay, so it's a Z80 computer basically.
Yeah.
But who's so, writing software for it? Like, is that a CPM version of Tetris then? Is that what that
I
is?
I guess it must be, yeah.
yeah.
Huh. So this actually was much more powerful than the ad would lead you to believe.
Yeah, yeah. That must be like WordStar or something that he's running in the video there.
Huh. Yeah, well, actually right now what he's doing is playing, I think, Hitchhiker's Guide.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Oh,
that's right. I forget that the Infocom games, many of them were yeah. ported to or had CPM
versions. Dude, like everything. Yeah, yeah. It's crazy huh. how many platforms those were ported to.
Oh, right. Okay, I'll leave it at that. We can move to closing discussions then. Carrington, any further news?
I got nothing. I have so little time, it's crazy. I thought I was supposed to have all this time in my life, and I don't. So I have my very excited to play, still sealed copy of Nox Archaeist. I think it's on the mm-hmm. table behind me. It's over there somewhere. So in my cluttered room. Can you see it? Oh, look, there it is.
Oh, yeah.
See my clutter? Still sealed. I will eventually open it up and play. I have been playing more of Harry the Handsome Executive, though, every once in a while.
That is a fun game.
And it's great. I'm surprised how well that's held up.
Like very clever.
Mm-hmm. So I've been playing that on the... That's kind of the only retro thing I've been doing, but...
All right. What have I been doing? I mean, I've been setting things up and trying to edit, and that's about it. I don't know.
The move is all done?
I'm going to have more to talk about. Sorry?
But have you settled into the new digs? Is that where you are now?
I'm sort of midway, you know. So lots of stuff is in boxes. Not, you know, the shelves and drawers and things that things will go into have yet to be built, you know. So, yeah, it's coming. It's coming along. But the Apple III is here. That's the main thing. Quinn, any closing
So not a ton of retro stuff here. My free time's all been consumed by my YouTube channel, which some viewers may know. I have a YouTube channel that we were talking about before the show is a second job. It's really consumed everything I have time-wise. But I think I've finally admitted that I'm done with Nox Archaeist. Enough time has passed since last I played it that I have to admit to myself that I won't have time for it again. But it was excellent, the time that I had with it. And I made it, I don't know, a quarter or a fifth of the way through, some small amount, but Definitely enjoyed doing that, and I'm glad that I supported that effort. Otherwise, I'm looking forward to my Mockingboard 4C arriving, and I'm taking suggestions on what to use to, or what to try to demo that, because I don't really know Mockingboard software, because I never had one, so I don't know. I mean, the Ultima 5 title screen is the only thing I know that had Mockingboard. So
Ultima 3 did too, I think, so for 3 and up at least.
Okay. Yeah.
That was the first title I remember, first box I got then on it.
Yeah.
I bought some software, see, and on it it said Mockingboard 3 compatible. Yeah. So I never had one though.
Okay, so yeah, if anyone has suggestions for software that made good use of it, I'd be curious to hear.
Mm.
And I did play with an Amiga emulator a little bit. I got one up and running, and I was immediately bewildered. So that didn't last
all that
long.
Book learning now.
Yeah, yeah. I actually bought. There's one. The company that Amiga Forever, I think, is the name of the company that officially owns the ROMs, and they sell a package that's $20 or something, and you get an officially licensed copy of the ROMs and a bunch of software and stuff. And so I bought that, and it's great. It just works. Like, you double click it and it boots. It's really slick. But then I'm just staring at this Amiga desktop, and I'm just like, okay, I have no idea what to do. That's that, and I've been following the Amiga Crack Screens Twitter feed. I think one of the ones that sort of came out from Kay Savitz's bot. I don't know if that's the same code or what, but there's all these crack screen bots now that you can follow, and there's an Amiga one. So I've been following that, looking for software that I should try, but it's just more confusing.
That's actually a good idea.
Most of it's like German or whatever, and I just have no idea what. And a lot of it is very childish teenage boy artwork, and I have no idea what I'm looking at, so it's not helping at all. It's giving me more questions, really.
It does seem like if you don't actually know how to use the machine, having it be also in German is not a help.
Exactly. That's one of the challenges with that platform, is that the real core, I think, of the audience for it was in Europe, so a lot of the software is PAL only, and a lot of the demos and stuff are from Europe, and so it's a little harder for North Americans to get into, but and otherwise I do intend to get back to my my 2GS game development. Jeremy Wren just finished his Centipede game for the 2GS that he's been working on, so that's kind of shaming me into getting back to working on my
Jeremy
my
shames
game.
Us all though, so just
yeah,
you know,
he knocked RKS'd me. Yeah. He started well after me and finished well before me, and so I've been
in fact,
knocked.
He did it in 3 days at Kansas Fest. Yeah, like, that's what he does.
Yeah. It looks fantastic, though.
It does.
I mean, like, it
yeah,
looks
well
like,
done, Jeremy.
It looks like you're yeah. playing the arcade game.
It's excellent. 60 yeah. frames per second. Yeah.
It's a real achievement.
Audio is all right. Yeah, it's beautiful. Anyway, that's it for me.
Cool. Yeah, I think I was. I remember thinking I wanted to try to track down a trackball for that specific game.
I have a 2GS trackball, actually.
Nice.
Yeah, I have the Kensington one that was where the ball was the exact same size as a billiard ball, and so you could replace it with an 8-ball, which I never did, but I loved the idea.
I wondered if you could. I mean, like I because it looked close and they felt equally heavy.
Yeah, at least the 2GS one you could. I don't know if they all were the right size, but yeah, I had a friend who had put an 8-ball in his. It does indeed work.
Very nice.
Yeah, my favorite trackball I ever had was for the Mac. It was the Silhouette trackball, and it held on the side, and it also came with like a. I think you got 5 different trackballs with it, and you could get all these wonky ones and stuff. And super fun.
Yeah, the Kensington one was cool because the ball just lifted right out of the top. Like, it wasn't retained at all. It literally just sat in
you
a little bowl.
Just throw it at people. Don't mess with Quinn. She's got a trackball. Just armed.
All right. I guess we can close up shop here. Thank you, everybody, for podcasting and following along. So that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast and our Facebook group at facebook.com/group/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. You can write a review on iTunes if you want. And until next time...
Retro-cute.